Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for January 2013. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. Intellectual property law is rarely considered to be glamorous or sexy, but sometimes the world of glamour and fashion intersects with IP law. Such was the case when fashion shoemaker Louboutin sued fashion house Yves Saint Laurent in the United States for infringement of Louboutin's registered trademark for women's shoes with red patent soles. Belinda Scrimenti is a partner at the Chicago law firm of Padishaw McAuliffe, Newbury Hilliard & Jarrelson LLP. Belinda has written at least twice on the subject of this case, once in March 2012 for an ABA IP section conference, and again in the fall of 2012 for a Padishaw McAuliffe newsletter, in an article entitled, 100 Years of Seeing Red, a Historical Perspective on the Second Circuit's Red Sole Shoe Mark Decision in Louboutin v. Yves Saint Laurent. Belinda kindly agreed to share her color commentary on the case with us. I spoke with Belinda from her office in Chicago. Hello, Belinda.
Hi, Don. Nice to speak with you.
Thank you for speaking with me. Let's start with the backstory and the history of colored trademark cases in the USA. In the article that you wrote about the Louboutin case, you recited the history of colored marks in the States, and you began with the Leschen rope case. Can you explain what that case was about?
Yes. The Leschen case is really the first case going all the way back to 1906 in U.S. jurisprudence. It was decided by our Supreme Court. And this was a product that is not nearly as sexy as Louboutin shoes, but it was heavy industrial wire rope made by a company at the time that used the trademark Hercules. And this was heavy wire rope that was, you know, your basic metallic color, but they ran a red strand woven through the wire. And they sought to obtain a trademark registration for the color of the wire itself with the red strand running through it. And in that case, the court basically denied trademark protection to the color red in the rope on the ground, essentially that you simply cannot have a trademark of a single color. The court did comment that a color could be protected within a particular design, such as a circle, square, triangle, cross, or star, but that the authority did not go further than that. So that, you know, really is where the history of our jurisprudence of color trademarks started.
And in your article, you continue with the color red, but jump ahead to 1949 and the Campbell Soup case. Can you tell us what that was about?
Yes, this was a case that did not involve a pure single color of red, but essentially the color red of the Campbell Soup's label, which is red on a white background and with some dark lettering. And in that case, again, another very important case from our U.S. Supreme Court, refused to protect the color red and the combination of the red and white colors on the ground that it would monopolize the color red in all shades for competitors. And this really sort of established the jurisprudence that really has carried on for some period of time after that the idea of protecting single colors simply should not be allowed on the ground that it would, you know, allow one competitor to really control the market by the use of a single color.
And again, in your article, by the 1980s, somebody else took a shot at patenting or trademarking, rather, not red but pink, and that was the Owens Corning pink insulation case. Can you explain what happened there?
Yes, and this really is the case that is sort of what I would consider, you know, the modern law of single color marks in the United States. This was not decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, but was decided by the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, which, for those of you not in the United States, is a special federal appellate court that had been created that decides a variety of different type of federal claims, but among them appeals from the U.S. Trademark and a Trial, U.S. Trademark and Trial, Trademark Trial and Appeal Board. And in that case, Owens Corning, which I think most people would recognize their pink fiberglass insulation, they have done quite a job of marketing the color pink. They color all of their insulation, both fiberglass and foam insulation, in the color pink. They also have a license to use the Pink Panther character to advertise their products. And the one thing that I think happens with Owens Corning is because it is so well known that people actually think that perhaps that's the natural color of fiberglass. But it's not. The natural color of fiberglass is a whitish yellow color. So in this case, Owens Corning sought to obtain a trademark registration for just the color pink as applied to its insulation. And in that case, the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board had refused to grant protection to the single color. That was appealed up to, as I said, our Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, and the court did find that the mark was registrable. The primary issue there was the doctrine of functionality, and it was where courts began looking at two types of functionality, one being utilitarian functionality, which is the idea that the product actually has a functional, either because of cost or the way something is manufactured, need to use the particular feature, in this case a color, which this was clearly not a functional aspect of it. And the other type of functionality that begins to play into these decisions is the doctrine of aesthetic functionality, which is the idea that something becomes effectively functional because out of competitive necessity, the competitors need to be able to use that particular visual feature, and in this case, that being the color. The court looked at the factual situation in the Owens Corning case and found that no other competitors used color on their insulation, and found there was no functionality to it, either utilitarian or aesthetic, and upheld the right of Owens Corning to obtain a trademark registration for the mark. It was subsequently registered, and since that time, Owens Corning has obtained many, many registrations for a whole line of its products for the color pink.
Now, maybe moving off to what I think is probably a famous mark, the pink insulation of Owens Corning, to something a little less exciting, is the green gold color for a company called Qualitex that it had for its dry cleaning press pads. I assume these are the pads that the clothes are put on when either the big machine comes down to press them, or whoever's doing it by hand is otherwise pressing the clothes. Is that right?
Yes, and that's what's interesting about this case is that the Qualitex case was decided subsequent to the Owens Corning case by our U.S. Supreme Court, and it really arose because as part of our legal practice, one of the grounds for cases to actually be accepted by the U.S. Supreme Court, which of course are a very small fraction of those which are appealed, are situations where there is a split of our federal circuits. And that's exactly what had happened here. The Owens Corning case, of course, had granted the right to protection of a single color. Our Eighth Circuit, which is states out west, but not California, had also granted the right in a case called Master Distributors versus PECO, to the protection of a single color. But on the other hand, there were two circuits that had refused protection to single colors. One was the Seventh Circuit, which is includes Illinois, in a case involving NutraSweets, blue sugar substitute packets, and also this Qualitex case involving these green color cleaning press pads. And And the one thing about it, it was sort of an odd shade of green, sort of a I think, ugly, greenish-gold shade, and as you say, not at all a well-known product in the general consumer market. So given that there was a split of circuits, they were able to have the case taken up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And that is, you know, the ultimate decision, which has subsequently defined the law in the United States of protection of single color marks. And the court really there did focus on several issues. One, it went through again this analysis of functionality and aesthetic functionality, and there, you know, unlike some of these other areas, you know, the aesthetics really are not important in this type of industry, and the court focused on what it is really the key to trademark law is the source distinguishing ability of a mark. And it said, one of the key quotes is, it is the source distinguishing ability of a mark, not its ontological status as color, shape, fragrance, word, or sign that permits it to serve these basic purposes. So the court considered the various functionality objections, found that this green gold color had no functional purpose. It rejected what had been developed to be called the color depletion theory, which is the idea that if each competitor would take one color, there wouldn't be any left for anybody else. The court rejected that and essentially said it would be a factual issue to be decided on a case-by-case basis. Go ahead.
In reading your notes from a decision in another paper you wrote, sort of before the Court of Appeal decision in the Louboutin case, you quote the fact that the court sort of took a why not attitude towards color marks in saying if a shape, a sound, and a fragrance can act as symbols, why, one might ask, can a color not do the same? So they seem to take a fairly open attitude in saying if you do have secondary meaning and meet the other characteristics of a trademark, why not allow a color to be a protectable mark? But they closed the door or didn't completely dismiss the chance of there being some type of aesthetic functionality. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And what the Qualitex case, I think, primarily said and is really how the law has been interpreted since, is it really took the focus back to where, you know, our common law trademark law has always been, which is the focus on secondary meaning. And, you know, in the end, it really is a factual analysis as to whether or not this particular mark, whether it's a word mark or a color mark or a scent mark, is, you know, sufficiently recognized by the consuming public to identify the source of the product.
One of the battlegrounds for color marks has been the color of pharmaceutical products, where perhaps if there's a pink pill to somebody with a heart condition, that might mean that that's their pink heart medication. And the generics have long and hard fought to say, we want to be able to make the pink pill along with the same chemical constituents so that the patient is not upset or disturbed by a change in the medication from a brand name to a generic, and let us use the same color tablet. Is that sort of the competitive aesthetic functionality that we're talking about here?
Yes, and that really dates to a case that actually predated the Owens Corning case. It was decided by the Supreme Court in 1982, although it was largely decided on a procedural basis in which it reversed the appellate court and essentially upheld the district court and on procedural grounds in upholding the district court's findings in the first instance that did go to the competitive necessity. In the case involved, most of these cases involved generic manufacturers trying to use the same color pill as the original branded manufacturers. And there were other factual issues in that case involving essentially fraud of the pharmacists improperly substituting medication without customers knowing it. But leaving that part of the case aside, the issue was, you know, exactly what you said, is that when it gets to the end user consumer who is not getting the product in the original cartons because they go to the pharmacists in, you know, large bulk containers, consumers, often elderly patients, rely on deciding which one is, you know, their blood pressure medicine, which one is their diabetic medicine, whatever, based on the color of the pill. And the idea there is competitive necessity, in that it's actually more of a functional utility even than an aesthetic utility.
So now let's move ahead to the Louboutin case, the case at hand or at foot, as the case may be. Can you tell us or explain to the uninitiated, maybe those people who don't watch Sex and the City, what is the Louboutin registration and what did it cover?
Well, the Louboutin registration was for a mark that is based on a drawing, and in the U.S. trademark system, the drawing is what really controls. It was a hand-drawn drawing of a very high-heeled shoe, and you see in the drawing of the shoe that the sole of the shoe is colored a very bright red. The drawing and the language that goes with the registration does not identify that color by any particular Pantone or other scheme color. But the only description that goes with it is the phrase, quote, "The mark consists of a lacquered red sole on footwear." And that registration was obtained under our Section 2F of the Trademark Act, which means that they had to prove secondary meaning.
So what did Yves Saint Laurent shoes look like?
The Yves Saint Laurent shoes were monochromatic red shoes, and they were part of a line in which Yves Saint Laurent had a line, I believe, of four different monochromatic shoes. There was a pair of shoes that were all blue, a pair of shoes that were all green, for example, and this pair of shoes that was all red, both the uppers and the lowers. And these were the shoes that Louboutin proceeded with the case on. I should add that prior to this case being brought, it's my understanding and pretty common knowledge that Louboutin, not surprisingly, had a huge problem with counterfeit imitations of their shoes. So they had brought, you know, a number of cases against garden variety counterfeiters, which were sort of slam dunk easy cases, and they never really had to litigate these issues until they decided to sue Yves Saint Laurent.
Now, before we discuss what the District Court and the Second Circuit did in this case, what were Yves Saint Laurent's main arguments?
Well, there was actually, apart from the arguments on the color red, there was actually apparently some factual issues as to whether or not Yves Saint Laurent had used red soles even prior to Louboutin, again, in this kind of context. But the primary arguments were that it was essentially a monopolization of the color, and that in the world of fashion, it is different than, say, Owens Corning insulation, in that you can't restrict a particular color in fashion. And also the idea that their shoes were different, that the whole concept of monochromatic shoes was a unique idea that they had had. They argued that they had been the first to have monochromatic shoes, and there was simply, in the end, under a traditional trademark analysis, there was simply no confusion. They also had counterclaimed against Louboutin, and among their counterclaims, they sought to cancel the registration.
So what did the district court decide?
In this case, the district court really went much further than many trademark practitioners here think should be done. First of all, the court in so many words, effectively granted an entire summary judgment against Louboutin, although it did not do that factually, but it essentially said that he was going to. But the decision initially was brought procedurally in the context of a motion for preliminary injunction. So the technical ruling was a denial of a motion for preliminary injunction on the ground that Louboutin was not likely to succeed on the merits of the injunction. But in the course of the opinion, the judge just really went off on and on outlining why there should be no protection of a single color in the world of fashion. And a part of the decision that has been particularly heavily criticized is a part of it where he compared it to the art world and admittedly created sort of a fictional hypothetical in which he compared Picasso and Monet paintings from Picasso's Blue Period and used that to argue that this would effectively lead to, again, what was called the color depletion theory in the past. So he then proceeded to find that the Louboutin registration should be invalidated, and he went on to apply the doctrine of aesthetic functionality to do that. Laced with that, the opinion really just contains a lot of really somewhat outrageous language that really goes way beyond the facts of the case and the necessary law to reach the decision that he did. And he then tells the parties that while procedurally he cannot grant summary judgment without notice and briefing, that's essentially what he would do when a motion is brought in front of him.
So with that decision being much to the horror of the fashion industry, what did the Second Circuit do with that decision?
Well, thankfully, the Second Circuit came to the rescue of not only the fashion industry, really, but many industries that rely on color marks. And that was really the big concern among trademark practitioners and the industry, in that some of this language in the district court decision was so overly broad. And the Second Circuit really brought the law back to where it belonged. It basically focused again on the Qualitex opinion, focused on the fairly narrow test for aesthetic functionality of competitive necessity, and focused heavily on the need to consider the issue of secondary meaning. The Second Circuit, as to the specific facts of this case, upheld the ultimate decision in Yves Saint Laurent's favor as to the claims in the case in finding no infringement, but it reversed the district court's decision to invalidate Louboutin's trademark registration. But the third thing that it did, which does seem fair and appropriate under the facts, is that it did, under the powers of the court under our Trademark Act, limited Louboutin's trademark registration, where before it was simply a lacquered red sole on footwear. It limited it to be a lacquered red sole on footwear with contrasting uppers. So once it found that the trademark itself was the red sole, but only where there were contrasting uppers to the shoes, then it was, you know, a very easy next step to conclude that because the Yves Saint Laurent shoe did not have contrasting uppers, it could no longer be an infringement. And it used that to conclude that there was no infringement. The court, you know, went on to, it's a very lengthy opinion, most of which is a very good outline of the history of color mark law and aesthetic functionality, and it really, you know, laid it out well to kind of put the law back where it had been before the district court decision.
And does that completely put an end to the litigation between Yves Saint Laurent and Louboutin with respect to this registration?
No, that procedurally that did not. Louboutin, of course, could have appealed or tried to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court eventually, but procedurally the case was then remanded back to the district court for a decision consistent with the opinion. And subsequent to that, in fact, on December 27th last year, the district court did finally enter an order of dismissal, which, at least by reading the language of it, appears that it was essentially agreed to by the parties, in which the case as to Louboutin was dismissed. The order reads, Louboutin acknowledges that based on the Second Circuit's decision, Louboutin has no further claims in this case or otherwise arising from the trademark of Louboutin as modified by the Court of Appeals against YSL over red monochrome shoes. Then apparently there was agreement, and YSL's various counterclaims, some were dismissed without prejudice and some with prejudice. So that should bring an end to the case at that point, technically. Now, the interesting thing that has happened, however, is that as part of that Second Circuit order, it orders our U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to modify the registration. And the fight seems now to have moved on to the Trademark Office. Amazingly, in looking at the record, the parties have now filed some 40, 50 pages of briefing to the Solicitor General's Office of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office as to the exact language that should be used on modifying the registration. And that action by the Trademark Office has not been finalized yet.
So, Belinda, where do you see things going now in terms of colored marks in light of the Louboutin decision?
Well, I think the one lesson, hopefully, is that counsel will perhaps be a little more careful in what cases they bring, because I think, you know, this is a case that a lot of people feel was sort of bad facts make bad law type situation. And but I think as to the law itself, I think it will continue pretty much along the way that we have seen it. I think it will continue to be a situation where the courts should focus really on the level of secondary meaning and whether or not a particular color or feature really does have source identifying qualities. You know, another sort of interesting ones that you can think of, there are, you know, you think of the color brown, and UPS really has, you know, they advertise, you know, what can brown do for you? Another sort of interesting registration on our register, I don't know if those of you in Canada are familiar with it, but a sort of mid-tier university in Boise, Idaho, called Boise State, has a blue football field. And that it's artificial turf colored blue. It looks very strange on television. But if you see a blue football field, you know which university it is. And they've actually got a registration for their blue football field. Their team colors are also blue and white. And, you know, it does kind of raise the question, what if some other team with blue and white colors wants to, you know, have a blue football field? And there's still a lot to be decided out there, but as the world, you know, product has become so universal, trademarks, the visual aspects of them become more and more important in an international economy, I think you will continue to see greater and greater protection of these type of marks, but with greater care of demonstrating secondary meaning.
Thank you very much for these insights, Belinda.
Thank you, Don. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
My pleasure. Belinda Scrimeti is a partner at the Chicago law firm of Pattyshaw McAuliffe, Newbury Hilliard, and Jarrelson LLP. For further information on Belinda Scrimeti, her firm, Pattyshaw McAuliffe, for a link to Belinda's newsletter on the Louboutin case and the history of colored trademarks in the United States, And for information on other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You've been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.